Maybe you flipped through cable channels and landed on C-SPAN when it was showing Question Time in the UK Parliament from London. The Prime Minister comes in and answers questions from members of the House of Commons, and everyone refers to everyone else as the Right Honourable Gentleman and the Right Honourable Lady. But if the people in the seats don't like what's being said, they act like the home crowd heckling the visiting team at a football game. So it's not just an American thing that civil discourse can be rude and even dehumanizing. Our guest this hour looked into why and what might change that. James Hogan is the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. Jim Hogan comes to this from the public relations industry. He's the president of the PR firm Hogan & Associates in Vancouver, BC. Jim works to reveal PR efforts to obscure climate science at Desmog Blog, and he's written two previous books. This book is now in a second edition, having been previously published in 2016. Jim Hogan, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So since 2016, yes, there's certainly more to say about public discourse since that time, huh?
Yeah, I would say things have changed quite a bit over 2 years. I did my first press conference in the 70s, and I don't think I've seen that dramatic a change in the way people conduct themselves in the public square over the 30-plus years. It is astonishing. And it's, as you say, it's not just the U.S. It's everywhere.
Well, and the way in which, the usual comeback is, well, everybody does it. So how do you address the people who say, well, they're all idiots. Nobody tells the truth. Nobody speaks nicely to each other.
Yeah. I think that it's not that I'm saying that there aren't some idiots out there. But I think if you feel like you're surrounded by them, you probably want to have your psyche checked. Because it may not be them. I think what ends up happening when you tribalize public discourse and you create this sort of warlike this permission to engage with people in a warlike manner and it's all based on a kind of an unyielding one-sidedness, that is kind of off balance. I mean, in healthy democracies, we need passionate debate, and we need to stand up for what's right and what's true and for the evidence. But we also need a dialogue which counterbalances the sort of scrappiness of democracy. And I think what's happened is that the scales are all off whack now, and being a reasonable person is seen as weak. Being someone who's willing to listen to someone who disagrees with them is seen as soft.
Mm-hmm.
That is just actually the process of human communication, the to and fro of it.
We've gone beyond calling each other opponents, and it's gotten to enemies, and it has been for a while now.
That's right, and I think that there's something that one of the people that I interviewed for my book, his name is Roger Connor, and he teaches conflict resolution. And he used to be like this rabid environmentalist. He called himself a name-em, blame-em, shame-em environmentalist who changed his mind about what he was doing because he felt that what was happening was that he and people who worked with him, even though they had really good intentions, had fallen into what he called an advocacy trap. And he described it as, look, good people do bad things for good reasons. And if you don't see that, when you're involved in something that's important and you take a position, particularly when you take a position publicly, and someone disagrees with you, at first you try to correct them and set the record straight. But if they persist, you start to question their motives, and pretty soon they're not just wrong, they're a wrongdoer, and they're an idiot or they're stupid. And the whole kind of nature of advocacy starts to change so that you get to a point where defeating the opponent is more important than the issue you were working on to begin with. And it's really kind of an exhausting exercise for advocates on all sides, on both sides. And so the idea is that when you do this, when you fall into this advocacy trap, you unknowingly strengthen the opposition to what it is you're trying to do, because the other person feels the same way about being attacked. So as you're doubling down, they're doubling down. And so the world is full of these examples of people who overplay their hands, and they take it too far, and then what happens is they actually strengthen the other side. So it's not just, I'm not just talking about maybe what advice that the Dalai Lama might give you about warm-heartedness and being a nice person. This is just tactically ineffective to constantly be demonizing people who disagree with you.
Does our knack for seeing patterns and creating stories work against us, Jim?
I think that our knack for creating stories, I mean, human beings understand the world through stories, and the great leaders and communicators are great storytellers. We have to be really careful with these stories to make sure that they're kind of rooted in reality, but nevertheless, stories are sort of powerful. It's my belief that our stories have to be more pluralistic, in the sense that both sides should be able to see themselves in the story as good characters. If your story is divisive and requires that the other side be humiliated or admit that they're wrong and beg your forgiveness for their stupidity, you're not going to get very far with your story. So I think we need to get better at being aware of our how we feel and how we're making other people feel in our storytelling.
Take us into the format of the book, if you would, Jim, because this is not just coming from you.
No. I was on the board of the David Suzuki Foundation and ended up being the chair for about 10 years. And at the same time, I was a chair of of Al Gore's climate project in Canada. And one of the things that concerned me was, as I learned more about the science, as you would, reading your board packages, it just was really alarming to me that I would see these debates where climate scientists were losing a debate, even though they had all the science on their side, to someone on the other side who had virtually no science and really didn't even have any background in science. And I started to wonder why it was, why there was this big gap between what the science was trying to tell us and all this shouting in the public square. And so I decided that, I really actually didn't know. So I started talking to people, and I ended up interviewing about 70 people around the world: Peter Senge, Otto Scharmer, Bruno Latour. These are people who are like great public intellectuals from MIT and Sciences Po in Paris and Cambridge. And I traveled for a few years. I even interviewed the Dalai Lama. And I just asked them, why is it that we're listening to each other shout rather than what the evidence is trying to tell us? And where is all this kind of name-calling and demonization of people who disagree with us coming from? And so this is obviously a very complicated area, but I'll tell you, I was just overwhelmed by the wisdom of people who've been spending their entire lives studying this problem.
And I should point out that climate change is often the topic of discussion that gets people most tied up in knots. But how do you break through, for one thing, the belief that the people who say, well, look, I keep this level of discourse, I talk like this because I am pointing out my opponent's lies?
I think that being right is no excuse for an inability to communicate and develop relationships with people, even when we disagree with them. So just because you're right about something, it doesn't give you permission to disrespect or not listen to someone else. Most people who, the idea that someone is an idiot on something, that's usually not true, or at least often not true. And there's usually a point. If you spend enough time looking, there's a reason that people feel what they do, and they may be mistaken about something, but you can be a decent person and be wrong. And I think a lot of the time, and this is kind of embarrassing to admit because I've been in the public relations business a lot of years, but one of the things I learned from all these people that I spoke to, mainly the social scientists, was that human beings aren't what I thought they were. It's not like everybody is as rational as I assumed. People are very complex. A lot of the way we behave and the opinions that we form are unconscious. We don't know the kind of social psychology of not wanting to admit we made a mistake, but there's very powerful forces at work that get people to dig in and protect their own decisions and beliefs, and particularly if they're doing it in public. And so how you actually unravel all that and not trigger it is it takes a bit of attention and a bit of work.
Our guest again, Jim Hogan on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. A lot of interviews in the book, including one at the beginning with David Yankelevich. How does he explain the difference between dialogue and debate?
Yeah, so in a debate, I think the main point that he makes is that when we debate someone, we assume that we're right and they're wrong, and we look for ways to sell our point of view and undermine theirs. In dialogue, so you believe you in a debate, you have the answer. Mm-hmm. In a dialogue, you approach it to learn that and it's based on this belief that everybody has a piece of the answer, and it's through sort of surfacing the conversation that you can come to a richer, broader understanding of an issue. And one of the things I've seen over the years with dialogues that I've done around the world on important issues, energy issues, climate, environmental issues, is that if the conversation is structured well, you can move from stereotypes that people have and mistaken beliefs that they have about the other side to a totally different perception around the table. And it doesn't mean that you stop believing what you know to be true because it's based on massive amounts of evidence that you have and your personal experience. It's not like you have to give up your grip on the truth. It's that and it's not even that you get to a point where you're just being more civil. It's that you get to a point where there's a sort of a to and fro between what your interests are, what you know, and the same in the other people. And it's quite amazing what I've seen over the years. Dialogue is an incredibly powerful tool. It doesn't mean that there's no room for debate, because in democracies you need debate. But I think it needs to be balanced with dialogue.
So the argument that that you know you're going to get blasted by your own people if you look like you're compromising undermines the idea that you're talking about here, which is that you're not going to lose the grip on the reality or the truth just by letting the other person talk.
Yeah, I think that and that's a real tough one. I've run into my fair amount of resistance from people who think that what I'm doing is trying to sort of, you know, cut the baby in half. And that's not what I'm talking about at all. I think one of the ways to deal with that is just to talk about what social psychology shows us about how when I disagree, or particularly when I disrespect an opponent's values, that actually strengthens the unreasonableness on the other side. Just assuming that the person is like dead wrong about something, if you disrespect them and disrespect their values, they don't change their mind. They double down. And so there's a tactical advantage in being a listener, trying to kind of understand how people are feeling and what where their values are and why they've come to understand these things, and trying to create some common ground so that you can later disagree. And so that's how I try to deal with that. But, I mean, there are that's the problem with the advocacy trap is, when you get there, it's like, that's not something people like us believe. And if you do believe that, you can't be one of us. You must be one of them. And so you end up in that, and that's the problem with it. It just, you know, when the psychology of teams and tribalism takes over, people's minds shut down.
Jim Hogan, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book is called I'm Right and You're an Idiot, subtitled The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. We will have some suggestions for doing that as we move through the hour. You can join the conversation on the Exchange with your own thoughts, questions, comments, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It's glad to see the name Carol Tavris in the book. She was here on the program 4 years ago talking about self-justifying delusions. So part of this, as you were just in the vein you were just talking about, where if you challenge somebody too heavily, they double down. We really have this need to comfort ourselves that we are right.
That's right. And that's what she, and the thing that's interesting about Carol, who's brilliant, what I learned from her is that it's, a lot of this is unconscious. You know, as soon as we make a decision, we start to look for ways to confirm that we were right about the decision, and we start to dismiss any suggestion that we were wrong about it. We don't like to admit we're wrong. The more public that process is, the more face we put into it, the more effort we put into it, the more money we put into it, the more it's part of our community beliefs or efforts, the harder it is to backtrack. And so this is a process, and she says it's as powerful as thirst and hunger. So these are very powerful forces that are at work on us, and we have to be careful if we're trying to communicate to someone, trying to persuade them of something, that we don't trigger that self-justification. Other people that I interviewed called it other things, like cultural cognition or the psychology of teams, but it's very similar type of thing where you're basically defending what it is that you believe and the decisions that you've made just because that's the way the human mind works.
Well, and this so section of the book does remind us that humans do resist a lot of solid information. Like we resisted the idea that cigarettes could hurt us. We resisted the idea that seatbelts could save our lives. And we've finally turned the corner on those, I think.
Yeah, human beings are wrong a lot. And so it's a really good thing, whether you're on the left or on the right, to keep in mind that you too could unknowingly be under the influence of bias, that you could be wrong.
So there's an interesting portion of the book here where you talk about some experiments that Lee Ross did with presenting two Israeli and Palestinian groups peace plans, and he wasn't entirely honest about where those plans originated.
Right, and basically the point was that people tend to agree with information that comes from people like them. So the same plan that comes from a Palestinian is seen as really bad, but if it comes from an Israeli to the Israeli, it's seen as good. And it's based on the research by Dan Kahan. He researches something called cultural cognition, which is basically this tendency people have to listen to someone, say someone giving a speech, and decide whether or not that person is like them or whether or not their beliefs are like their beliefs, and then after that decide what they think about what the person is saying, rather than the other way around. We like to see ourselves as rational and processing information, but in fact that's not true. We're very tribal. Just by nature, we tend to divide up into groups and then adhere to the beliefs of those groups. And if somebody comes along with evidence that contradicts the beliefs of our group, we don't change our beliefs. We change the evidence. And so trying to communicate with human beings who go through that kind of a process is extremely difficult. And you need to do it thoughtfully.
Well, and Dan Kahan reconfirmed for you the futility of arguing facts and evidence. If you don't have facts and evidence to rely upon, then what?
Yeah, and I don't think he would argue that facts and evidence are not important. He certainly wouldn't, and nor would I. But I think he would argue that they're not enough. Because when someone is caught in the grip of cultural cognition, you're not actually having a conversation about facts. And what they found, interestingly enough, is in his research, it doesn't matter how well educated you are. Education doesn't really have much of an effect on this cultural cognition problem. But I think what's more likely to is a dialogue-based conversation. And so it's not like people can't change their minds. It's just that you have to be cautious if you're trying to do it, because if they think that you're just trying to shove your ideas down their throat, then they resist. And it doesn't take a lot to look like, for someone who's in this state of cultural cognition, for them to perceive that someone's trying to push their ideas. So this whole idea of debate has its limits, you know, the idea of selling your idea to someone else. So to me, you know, 30 plus years of being in the communications business, this book taught me that communications will fail unless it's two-way. Unless both people get the sense that they both have something to offer, both people feel listened to and respected, it's likely that the communications will fail. And so if you just keep trying to hammer away at the facts, you just either are wasting your time or even making it worse.
Which leads us into the section of the book you call Failure to Communicate. And George Lakoff says you need to talk values then. So you're trying to find a common ground that, what, is not necessarily part of the subject matter you're talking about at hand?
Not necessarily, and I would add to that shared values. So what dialogue does is it explores a situation in the hope that you will find shared values. And so you may be disagreeing, I don't know, about you may be disagreeing about immigration, or you may be disagreeing about gun control. But in the midst of those conversations is common ground. Now, it may be small in some cases, but I would say the strategy has to be to make progress. The strategy has to be find some common ground before you get to the differing points of view. If you just start with the disagreement, with the debate, then you end up just spinning your wheels.
So on the subject, for example, of climate change, if you start by saying, hey, look, you know, we want a healthy planet, that seems like a universal value. We want healthy economies and families fed and you know, all these things. We agree on these. I mean, is that the way you'd approach it?
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's that plus, you know, asking open-ended questions, like, how is it that someone's come to think that? Where do they, how did they learn? You know, rather than bringing an attitude that makes the person feel that their views are under attack, you know, looking at questions and trying to explore common values.
Let's take stock then of where we've gotten to so far, Jim, because it seems like we're talking about essentially appealing to shared humanity and emotions up to a point, but not necessarily so much reason.
I would say that you need to, we need to increase the emotional dialogue, part of conversations. But that I don't think that means that you have to give up on reason. So I think it's, you know, you talk to people's heads and their hearts. And so I do think that facts are part of conversations. I think that, you know, moral beliefs obviously are part of it. You know, there are things that we know to be right and we feel to be right, and there's no suggestion from me that that's not good. That's a really good thing. Thank God for people. Thank God for Bill McKibben, you know, even though he raises hell all the time.
Right.
if we didn't have people like Bill McKibben in the world, the world would not be as good a place. So I'm not suggesting that facts aren't important and reasons not important. I'm just saying that the emotional part of it and the conversation around shared values is something we can't leave missing.
Let us take some calls. We have Jim in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Hogan.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. The thing that I, first off, before we went to break, we talked about shared values and saying that we all value a healthy planet. I would posit that the people who are climate deniers don't think we have a problem with a planet that isn't healthy. So that's kind of a challenge to try to get at that root. They just don't see there's a threat to the planet. But getting to my question, I have a couple questions for Mr. Hogan. How successful has he been in getting on the more conservative talk radio? Because we're going to have good dialogue. Both sides need to hear his message. And the other thing is, I tend to focus on evaluating logical fallacies, such as ad hominem attacks, the slippery slope, and the one that I see a lot is calling somebody a hypocrite in response to their claims about something, which they may be a hypocrite, but it does nothing to dispute their original claim. So if he could speak to that, I'll take it off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate that. So logical fallacies and the conservative response to your book and your talk.
Yeah, so I think I'm actually, tomorrow I'm doing a couple of conservative interviews, radio shows, and I think one of them is actually a talk radio show. So I'm not sure that they are sort of cheering, like lining up to do it, but I have been on a few, and interestingly enough, just for the subject matter I'm talking about, leaving out beliefs in climate change and all that, they are in total agreement. And so having a conversation with most of the conservative radio guys that I've talked to over the last couple of years has been very similar than talking to liberal interviewers. So I know there's a difference. But I don't really see it. Maybe they're just not as interested. But let me just go to what I feel is the kind of essence of that those questions. So this is like strategic, and as a communications person, I ask myself when I'm dealing with a big issue, what is it that people think about when they think about that issue? What's the broad public narrative or story about that issue? I would argue that when you see an issue like climate change that has kind of fallen into the grip of cultural cognition and into this kind of partisan, that almost like the science has become partisan, which is very odd, but nevertheless, that's what's happened to it. Once that happens, essentially, you stop the conversation or you stop the narrative from moving forward. And so, if we want something, and this is like, I would imagine that I probably have been more combative on climate change than most of your listeners. If you look at DSmog blog or Climate Cover Up, the book I wrote, it's very aggressive. And I have to tell you that there's a certain point where you don't want to continue creating a narrative of us versus them. And it doesn't mean that you have to try to get people who are never going to change their minds to agree with you. I would say don't waste your time on that. But the question I would put forward is, do you want to continue this us versus them narrative? And I would say no. And there are people who are doing some really good work, particularly in the United States, talking to Republicans about everything from carbon pricing to climate mitigation and learning ways that you can do it and have those conversations. You know, when you have entire towns burning down in Northern California from wildfires, or you have these horrible floods, and it's not like that's lost on people, the numbers of people who are worried about climate change, whether they're conservatives or liberals, is increasing in the United States steadily. And so I think we have to be very careful about managing the public narrative around us versus them. And strategically, that would be my response to those questions.
I'm not sure if the news got to you in Vancouver, but you're talking to us in the week after the Oregon Senate's business was stopped cold on the verge of passing what looked like passage of a cap and trade bill because the Republicans all walked out, so there couldn't be a quorum in the Oregon Senate. And that went on for 5 days.
Yeah, I saw that.
Okay.
That's exactly the thing I'm talking about, right?
Right.
But what I would say is that just because you're right on that doesn't mean that the smartest thing to do is fight about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think trying to look for ways to diffuse it and ensure that there's a political cost for that kind of behavior is a better way to spend your time.
Let's take another call here. We have Karen in Mount Shasta on the phone. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Hogan, who wrote, "I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up."
Yeah, hello. I have a really good friend that loves Trump, and I was wondering, there's been several times when, I mean, I usually just say we just don't talk about anything political, but there'll be something that Trump does that I'm in favor of, and I try and bring it up, and it's like opening a can of worms because she just takes off and just dominates, you know, goes into everything. I can't bring up something that I agree with because she'll just dominate and go on. How do you carry on a conversation with someone like that?
Wow, it's an excellent question. Thanks for that, Karen, for sharing the story.
Wow. I was afraid that question was going to come up. I mean, it's like the important question. My book doesn't go into that as directly as I would like, actually, looking back on it. I think that's why I'm working on another book. But one of the things that I'm doing to work on this other book is taking these workshops from a group called Smart Politics. And what they're doing is they basically coach people and train people on having those conversations. And the reason, and it's a great, it's a woman who, she's a psychiatrist and a political psychologist, and brilliant. And she basically takes people through these workshops she has a process that you go through. But I think a big part of it, what I've been learning from her, is being aware of the emotional conversation that's going on, and being aware of how you're feeling and how the conversation is making the person you're talking to feel. And that, I think, a lot of the time when you get into these arguments, what happens is you're starting to actually occupy a different part of your brain, the amygdala, which is where the fight or flight is. And what happens when you light up your amygdala, your frontal cortex, where your thinking mainly happens, shuts down. And so that can happen on both sides. And so you being aware of the emotional part of the conversation is really important. But there's a whole process that the people at Smart Politics are working on, and I think the work they're doing is fantastic. These things are critically important. Social change basically happens around family social gatherings. We cannot fight all the time on this stuff, and we can't avoid it. So, you know, good on that woman who just called in for basically trying to have the conversation. We can't stop from having these conversations if we want to see change.
Karen, thanks again for the call. Here's one from Al in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Hogan.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment, two comments actually. One is with regard to the problem is sometimes, from my own observation actually, sometimes the one's knowledge or information becomes mixed with the ego. And once that it gets mixed with the ego, then the person feels being wronged or being attacked. The second one, you guys brought the Palestinian and the Israelis issue. I mean, how do you like it? Either one of you, if somebody come and throw you out of your house, or if you're lucky, you end up in the doghouse. And that's what happened to the Palestinians. And then tell you that God promised them your house. I'd like to take your comment out of the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Al. Appreciate it.
So again, what was the first question again? Sorry. It was, the ego.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, ego and taking matters personally, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what I'm talking about with this emotional awareness and being aware of when you get triggered, how you get triggered, what do you feel like when that happens? How are you making them feel? And just being more aware of the emotional dialogue that's taking place. I think a lot of the time, when you live in a highly polarized society, what happens, a big part of what happens is that people become more isolated. And part of the isolation, the way that we defend ourselves in that kind of a society, is by living in our heads more than our hearts. And so being more aware of how you and the other person are feeling is a critical part of communication. In fact, I would say that the entire public relations industry is based on the observation that was made by the early fathers of public relations in the 1930s, that whenever if facts get in a fight with emotions, that emotions win. And so you have to have emotional meaning, which is basically this kind of shared values area that I'm talking about. There has to be emotional meaning in the conversation, but you can't have that unless you're aware of how you and the other person are feeling.
That example you gave, though, about how we have to have these discussions in family dinners and things like that, and I'm reminded of the fact that at least in a family, you know that you may completely disagree with the person, but you're still related to them. And I think what you're saying is if we can get to a situation where we think about the same sort of thing as human beings, that like we still have something we share here, it might actually help the process to get to some point where we can at least have a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people who have unsuccessful conversations, even with, I'm thinking of myself a couple of years ago where I was at a friend's house and there was a woman there, and I said something about George Bush. I just kind of flipped it, just said it, mm-hmm. without thinking, not even knowing who she was, right? And she really reacted to it. And then everybody around the table agreed with me. And I think back on that, and I'm embarrassed by it. I mean, how insensitive and rude. I think that we need to learn how to have these conversations. But I have a lot of friends who are Americans who say they just don't even raise the issue. They won't even talk about it.
Well, we lose something if we don't talk to each other, and that is one of the major points of the book. It is I'm Right and You're an Idiot. I like to think of the title as the before, and then the after is the subtitle, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. Jim Hogan, thanks for writing it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Take care.